history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. There are people with some incredible stories to tell, and we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We are educated, we're entertained, very often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And some of the most moving stories we've heard over the years involve the Nisei veterans of World War II, Japanese Americans who often were serving the very country that was holding their families captive. We're going to hear about the 442nd Regimental Combat Team today from a man who served in that famed Gopher Broke unit, Lawson Sakai of Morgan Hill, California, originally from Southern California. And Lawson, take me back to those days growing up in Los Angeles. When I hear you talk about acres of farmland in Los Angeles, that sounds a little incongruous. That's not the LA we know today. But what was it like as you were growing up?
We were actually 7 miles from downtown Los Angeles City Hall. I walked it one time, and there was a lot of open land between where we were and downtown LA, not like it is today. We had 5 acres, which, you know, it was a small greenhouse-type flower industry, but it was in a nice location and easy to get to market. So we also farmed 13 acres quite a ways away, out in the country, and we called it Blue Hills in those days. Currently, it's a country club near La Habra. All that farmland, there were no roads, just dirt roads that we drove on, and there were maybe 7 or 8 Japanese families farming chunks of land, various things, and we were also farming there. My summers were spent on the farm. Growing up through the Depression years, of course, everybody had to do something because, you know, it was tough going in the late 20s, early 30s.
Yeah, what do you remember about those times? And what about your family? Did you have brothers and sisters?
I had one older sister. We really were a very small family. Most of the families, Japanese families, had 5, 6, 7, 8 children. They had big families, and they're farmed a little bigger. But in our case, we're very small, and I think it was sufficient. I used to help my father whatever I could. I was going to school, so I couldn't help him very much. But the whole Japanese community, and they used to get together for their own parties, but they couldn't associate with anybody else. Number one, they didn't speak the language. And number two, the other people didn't want the Japanese to mingle with them. But they were becoming the best and biggest farmers, best and biggest flower growers, the best and biggest fishermen. They had a huge fishing fleet at Terminal Island. My uncle was driving a Chrysler Airflow around, which was the car in, you know, 1938-9.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of business jealousies and so forth, and a lot of pressure on the politicians to remove the Japanese, which was the talk, was send them to Japan, you know, after Pearl Harbor, you know, ship them all to Japan, whether they're American citizens or not. That, you know, so then they possibly could have if they wanted to, I'm sure. You know, they put 120,000 into camps.
Yeah.
It wouldn't take much more to start putting them on ships and sending them out. So that was kind of the rumor going around. But
even before Pearl Harbor, I'm interested in your experience, because clearly that was a differentiating point. But I understand you were a pretty good athlete. You played high school football and basketball, even some in junior college?
It was war years. I weighed 140 pounds.
Yeah.
I played a running guard at Compton Junior College. I graduated high school in 1941.
Mm-hmm.
So in September, I went to Compton Junior College, and the ranks were depleted, let's say. So I got to play second string football. And I also played baseball later before I left California. But
had you ever faced any kind of discrimination in school, being Japanese American?
Very little. Nothing really to speak of, because the teachers were good. Almost all of my friends, the students, were all good. When I went, of course, I knew almost everybody at Montebello High School. When I went to Compton, I knew maybe one other person, maybe two. I didn't know anybody else. They're all strangers, but we all got along fine. Mm-hmm. Really had a good time there. The coach, Ed Suggett, used to kid me a lot. He used to, when Japan attacks California, he says, are you going to attack me?
But I imagine that December 7th really changed your life. That's probably a pretty memorable day.
It didn't affect me as a student. The other students didn't say, what the hell's going on or anything. They, you know, it just, I don't think it affected them as students, and they never passed it on to me. I got along fine before and after Pearl Harbor. The only thing, of course, the newspapers, radio, and so forth, it's really gearing up for getting worse and worse every day.
And that day, specifically for you, December 7th, 1941, I like to ask every veteran this, Japanese American or otherwise, because they all seem to remember something. And do you remember that moment when you found out?
It was Sunday morning. I was doing homework. I was listening to my radio when the announcer broke in and said Pearl Harbor had been attacked. I didn't pay much attention to it because I really didn't know where Pearl Harbor was. Then as the news report kept coming on, it was like they would break in every 15 minutes or so and give you more information. Then, you know, it described how the battleships were being sunk and so forth. It was a pretty big deal. And then I realized how serious it really was. So it was kind of tough talking to my parents. They were working when they came in for lunch. You know, it was kind of, I broke the news to them and they were pretty shocked. They knew it was going to happen. And everything was pointing toward some kind of a confrontation. So I don't think they were surprised, but they were pretty disappointed that it did happen, because then now it's what's going to happen to us. You know, that was the thing. And then, of course, that afternoon, the FBI shows up and, you know, they take my uncle away. So,
and I want everyone to hear that, because I don't think people realize, especially people that weren't alive, this is really hard for them to fathom. The very day that Pearl Harbor happens, the FBI shows up and takes your uncle.
They took a lot of people on December 7th. They knew where everybody was.
And why do you feel that your uncle was targeted, that he was snatched up?
He was the leader of the United Farmers Association, UFA, the largest produce market, 9th Street Market in L.A., a big wheeler dealer. So, you know, when they take the head, that leaves the rest of the body lifeless. Mm-hmm. And that's what they were doing. They were picking up whoever, teachers, lawyers, doctors, businessmen, anybody that they considered a leader of the community, they hauled them away. And that usually left people underneath who really were kind of helpless, and families. In most cases, the men in those days did everything. Mm-hmm. The mothers just raised the family and helpless. Mm-hmm. This is what happened. All this kind of crippled the Japanese families. So it made it easy for the U.S. government to take the next step, which was putting everybody into the American concentration camps that were being built at the same time. In fact, who's the famous retirement villages all over the country? There's one, I think, in Roseville, Phoenix.
Del Webb?
Yeah, I think it is Del Webb. Yeah. I think he got his start building the Poston camp in Arizona.
Really?
Which is like 20,000 people were housed. So they're building these barracks, you know. So secretly, they're building these all over, well, all over Arkansas, Colorado, Idaho, Arizona, and the desert, very remote desert regions. But, you know, big 10,000, 12,000 units all of a sudden.
Yeah, it doesn't materialize out of thin air. And for you personally, when you see your uncle taken away by your government, that had to shock your system a little bit.
Yes, it you know, you wondered what, but, you know, at the same time, I'm an American citizen. I realize that my uncle is an immigrant and he cannot become a citizen by law. So I guess the government can do anything they want with somebody who's not a citizen. That's the way I looked at it. So what can we do about it? Nothing we can do.
Mm-hmm.
If they came to take me away, it's a different story because I am a citizen. So it hadn't reached that point at that time.
But it would only take a few months because in February, Executive Order 9066, and every February we mark that Remembrance Day. So I bet you were getting ready for baseball season at Compton Junior College.
Yeah.
And then you hear about the president saying Japanese Americans on the West Coast have to be relocated.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how did that feel? How did you react to that?
You know, I had classmates like, you know, through the Depression years, a lot of the, we called them Okies, Texas, Oklahoma, and Dust Bowl, a lot of them had migrated to the West Coast. And Bell Gardens, which is Southern California, were just kind of 99 or 100% from Oklahoma and so forth. Then a lot of those kids were going to school in that general area. Well, two of my good friends and classmates, one was Tex Winter, one was McCoy. But these guys are great basketball, track, you know, they were great athletes. You know, you probably know of Tex Winter. He was the L.A. Lakers assistant. He was Kansas State coach.
Yeah.
You know, a great basketball player. And he could pole vault. He went to USC. Compton Junior College was a USC, what would you call it,
a
holding theater school.
Yeah.
They would, in fact, when I played football, two of the biggest guys were from Iowa. They had been recruited for USC, but they were full at USC, so they put them in Compton JC for a year.
Yeah.
So going back to football, baseball, all these athletes were really great kids. We got along fine. And one of the strange things is that area now is 99, 100% black people.
Right.
I think we only had one black student or athlete. Spider Webb.
That's a great name.
His nickname was Spider. His name was Webb, W-E-B-B.
So but, you're getting you're there, and baseball season's about to start up, and Executive Order 9066.
Yeah.
What did that mean for you? How long was it till you were leaving California?
Well, we were told at that time that where they would draw a line north and south, and if you're on the east side, you don't have to leave California. So we're close to the coast. So we decided to move east of Highway 99. So we moved up near Delano, Porterville, and then go up the hill. There's a place called California Hot Springs, not too far from where you are.
Yeah.
And it just so happened the owner was a Seventh-day Adventist. And he had maybe 10, 12 cabins up there. So we moved into one.
Because that was your denomination also, your family.
You know, that was a connection. The church found the place, and so we moved up there. We were only up there 2 months, I think, and the order came, the whole state has to be evacuated. So everybody that was there were all given orders, pack up everything, and the bus is coming to take you to a camp. They didn't say where. And so we were ready to go, and then that's when we got the permit from the FBI to travel to Colorado.
So you got this permission that said you don't have to go to a camp, just go to Colorado and basically stay out of the way.
Yeah, once you left California, you were on your own.
Uh-huh.
But you could not stay in California.
Was this time for you and your father, your mother, your sister? How would you describe that? Was it scary? Was it uncertain?
Well, it had to be scary for my parents because they are immigrants and they don't speak the language well. And, of course, they look like the enemy, of course. And the newspapers and the radio is constantly saying, these are the enemy, don't trust them. And people are saying, let's get rid of them. You know, all that is going on, just hunt full force. So they never said anything to me like, gosh, I don't like what's going on or what, you know. They kept it to themselves. They never told me what their feelings were. But as I think back on it, they had to have really been thinking maybe they're going to be deported, sent to Japan. I'm sure that must have been what they were thinking. It was pretty hard on them financially, too, because the government froze the assets that they had in the U.S. banks. Mm-hmm. So, again, you know, lack of income. And I'm sure that, like my dad had plenty of cash, he was always going to the market with the produce and so forth. I'm sure it didn't go into the banks. It probably had, you know, I've stashed away someplace. Because when we went to Colorado, they had to have money. And apparently, I never knew what their finances were, but you know, they seem to do all right.
We're overdue for our first break, but when we come back, we'll find out one reason Lawson Sakai is thankful for that unexpected move to Colorado and how he ended up in the legendary Go for Broke unit, the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. Go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos and video connected to Mr. Sakai's story. And even better than that, a chance to hear him speak live in person. That's coming up next weekend, and he'll share those details with us. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country, and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.